Many would argue that Billy Graham is one of the most influential men of the last century, with the ear of many a president from Truman. Well, I vividly remember him getting Richard Nixon down on his knees in the Oval Office. When he came to Australia 60 years ago for his national tour, it's estimated that almost a quarter of the population went to see him. I was not among their number. I was disengaging myself from the Communist Party at the time, and it somehow didn't seem appropriate to change my mind that dramatically. Graham was charming, he was charismatic, and he left an enduring legacy here in Australia, and now his son is here for a 60th anniversary tour. And while he will not reach the same numbers as his father, there's no doubt that he too has friends in high places, particularly in the White House. He campaigned vigorously for Trump. Now, to remind us of the significance of the 59 tour and the legacy of Billy, I'm pleased to welcome to the studio, and he's actually physically here, Stuart Piggin. Stuart is Associate Professor at Macquarie University and the former Director of the Centre for the History of Christian Thought and Experience. What was that? What is that?
I was employed by the university in the Ancient History Department to relate issues of Christian thought from the ancient world to the modern world. I'm a modern historian put into the Ancient History Department. And so I just supervised 28 PhD students looking at issues like that. It was a wonderful, wonderful job.
Was it a bit like the Ramsey idea?
Well, I am very interested in that because I cannot quite understand why the universities are so allergic to taking this on. I would have thought that it would be an obvious way to get money to teach things that are important.
How Christian was Australia when Billy turned up?
Well, that is a very interesting question. I think Australia in the 1950s was actually one of the most Christianised nations on earth. I know that's a very unusual thing to say, but I've written a lot of stuff on this recently, and I think that there's a very good reason for it, and that is that in the 19th century, Australia had far more Christian ministers working within it than most European countries at the time because of the church acts. In every small community, you had four different churches, a Catholic, Anglican, Methodist and Presbyterian church. And this was not something that was duplicated in England, for example, where you had typically only one church. And so amazingly, every small community had four ministers going hammer and tongs. And I think that Australia was very Christianised in terms of values. One of the most Christianised nations probably on earth at that time. I don't know if you call it a Christian nation, but certainly was very Christianised in terms of values.
And yet we never seemed until relatively recently to get caught up in that sort of feverish religiosity of the United States, as evidenced by, well, as evidenced by Hillsong et al.
Well, Hillsong is an Australian invention. And
I'm painfully aware of that.
And I think also that Australia has experienced far more revival than we've been aware of. Secular historians just haven't written about it. In fact, that's how I got involved in writing about all this stuff in the first place. I was making a study of a mine disaster, Australia's biggest disaster before the recent bushfire in Victoria. But in 1902, 96 men and boys were killed in the Illawarra. And when I read the local paper, I found to my astonishment that there had been a genuine religious revival in all the coal mining towns along the Illawarra, and indeed throughout New South Wales. There were tent mission revivals done through the Vickery organisation. Vickery was one of the owners of the mines. But there seems to be a genuine religious revival, and I thought to myself at the time, this is astonishing. I didn't think we had revivals in Australia. And then I talked to a Marxist historian at Wollongong University, where I was teaching at the time. He said, "Look, in the local press, if you read about the South Coast, dairy farmers and the North Coast and the South Coast and all the rest, you'll find revivals all over the place." And I think there were lots of local revivals that we haven't noticed, but we've had some big ones. So California Taylor came to Australia in the 1860s. He reaped 7,000 souls. And then I think in 1902, Australia came pretty close to a general awakening. In the 1920s, Gypsy Smith was incredibly successful in his, in his, in his revivals.
We're talking about tent-style evangelists.
Yes, that's right, that's right.
But nothing was as big, nothing could be imagined as big as the Graham Crusade, 143,000 in Melbourne, 150,000 in Sydney.
Well, that was just the last meetings. I mean, there were 719,000 in Melbourne overall. 26,440 of those people accepted Billy's invitation to come to Christ, which is 3.7% of all those who attend. In Sydney, it was 980,000 who attended. 56,780 accepted the invitation to come to Christ. That's 5.8% of those who attended. So yes, the numbers were incredible. Overall, 1.24% of the entire population went forward at a Billy Graham crusade.
There is, of course, something electric about a large rally, whether it's a sporting event or a rock concert. Do you think that sort of induced this response?
I've heard theories about Billy being exceptionally emotional in this sort of context, that he was a Hitler figure, that he hypnotised people and that sort of thing. So I didn't actually go to a Billy Graham crusade in 1959 because I was too young and I was living in the country at the time. But when I did this research 30 years afterwards, I went to the Billy Graham event archives, and every afternoon when I was a bit weary, I watched a film of the Crusades and watched him preaching. And I thought he was electrifying, but I didn't think that he was terribly emotional. There weren't people weeping or anything like that, as you sometimes hear about in revivals. It was not like that. Billy seemed to go for comprehension first. He wanted people to understand what he was on about. He was very clear in his explanations. And I think that the reason why so many people responded and then so many stuck over such a long time, these were decisions which lasted so often. You had about a 60 or 70% continuation rate of those people who went forward, which is quite extraordinary.
Stuart, were the churches here welcoming, or did they fear erosion of their market share?
No, they were almost to a person totally welcoming. There were a few,
including the Catholics.
Well, no, the Catholics were not involved, but the Catholics were doing very well in the '50s anyway. They had these huge Marian processions and all the rest of it. Normally, denominations, when one denomination goes well, the others go well as well. Probably for similar reasons, but the Catholics were not involved, although there were some Catholics who did go forward at the Billy Graham Crusades. But the other churches, they welcomed Billy virtually to a man, and he actually orchestrated that himself. He said, "I don't come unless people are united and welcoming me all together." So he had a large number of groups of people who invited him in the first place, and that's part of the reason for his success, I think.
I have views on his political alignment, but I think you feel that he was pretty apolitical.
The interesting thing about Billy is that if you try to find out what might have been a temptation to Billy. See, right at the beginning of his career as an evangelist, someone took him aside and said, "Look, if you're going to make a success of this, you've got to make sure that you get three things right. You can't be in it for the money. You can't muck around with women, and you've got to be. You cannot exaggerate your statistics." So all these statistics we've got about Billy are interesting because he always had a committee of statistics. He was always interested in getting these things right. So I think that one of the reasons why we're so confident about a lot of these things to do with Billy is because of he was careful about those things. But one of the things that I think that he was tempted about was power, because he did have all these links with the presidents, as you said, and he was, by a country mile, the most respected person in the United States for a long, long time. And I think that it must have been a temptation to him for people to say, "Look, Billy, you could easily become president." But he never did. He always insisted that his job was to bring people to a personal relationship with Jesus.
Do you believe that he was sorely tempted?
I don't think it was ever a huge problem. I think he was a diplomatic sort of person, and he enjoyed mixing with all peoples. including those who were celebrity types. He seemed to have a natural ability to attract people like that, and I think he just found the whole thing very, very rewarding. He was very good at it. Billy Graham was a statesman, I think, and what that means is that he was, like all true statesmen, he was aware of the importance of bringing people together, so he's always stressing the importance of unity, and he was very conscious of his role, of his place in history, very conscious of that, and he was very aware that he believed that God might be doing something significant. And one of the reasons why he got so excited in Australia was that this up to that time, the most successful evangelistic campaign in the history of the world, as far as we knew. The reason why he got so excited about that was that he thought that maybe this was the beginning not only of a revival in Australia, but of a revival which could spread throughout the world.
You suggest that there's at least anecdotal evidence that crime dipped as a consequence of the crusade. I would point out that it also dipped in the ghettos whenever Cassius Clay, later Muhammad Ali, won a fight.
I was very interested in that question because I've made a bit of a study of revivals, and one of the defining characteristics of a revival is that it must reach out beyond the church. It cannot be just affecting church people. It's got to go out beyond that. And so I looked for the impact of the Billy Graham Crusades on crime figures. When I looked at them first of all, I thought, well, there's just no evidence here, because Australia massively went into reverse in the 50s and in the 60s. All the crime indices dramatically increased. And then I looked for indication of moral indicators like ex-nuptial births, and I found that those too increased dramatically in the 50s and the 60s. And then I looked at alcohol consumption. That also increased dramatically in the 50s and the 60s. So I thought, well, Billy hasn't made any impact. But I had a minister who was a PhD in science, who was very good at statistics. He said, that's hopeless. He said, you cannot look at five-year figures, which the statisticians talk about. You've got to look at the years and the months. And when I looked at the years, I found that indeed there was a dip in all those things in the year 59-60. He made an impact on the amount of crime, on ex-nuptial births, and there was a 10% reduction in the consumption of alcohol. I don't know if he caused it, of course, but I'm saying that those things happened at the same time. I got interested in that because a magistrate called A.E. Debenham, who was 92 when I interviewed him. He must have been 62, 30 years earlier when Billy was around. And he said to the press that there's been a 50% reduction in crime in Australia as a result of Billy Graham. So that's what made me look for it in the first place.
Oh, dear, so much to talk about, so little time. I should, as I said earlier, his son Franklin has been pushing the Trump barrow for some considerable time, here to mark the 60th anniversary, not pulling the same crowds, but, as you say, a fascinating phenomenon. And I thank you for your time. Associate Professor Stuart Piggin, former Director of the Centre for the History of Christian Thought and Experience at Macquarie University.
Thank you, Philip.
Coming up, the Journal of Dangerous Ideas.